You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just read this amazing piece by Peter Barnes a couple of days ago, originally published on his website on thecommons.org. I saw it over at commondreams.org. And, you know, it's one of those pieces that's just like making it around. And I was so impressed by it. I said to Sean and Louise, we've got to get Peter on the program to talk about this. It is, and therefore here he is. Peter Barnes is on the line with us on thecommons.org, his website. He's a journalist, the author of his most recent book, Capitalism 3.0, A Guide to Reclaiming the Commons. And Peter, welcome to the program.
Yes, good to be here, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You have suggested, how to restore the middle class. Let everyone earn dividends from our commonwealth. In other words, let's turn all of us into little mini Mitt Romneys, living off our a dividend income derived from our common investment. Please explain.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, the middle class is in trouble, as you have been pointing out. Everybody knows this. We feel it. Now, what are we going to do about this? If you talk to any politician, Republican or Democrat, they'll say, well, the solution is jobs, jobs, jobs. That's the way we did it in the past, and that's the way we're going to build a middle class in the future. But that is not simply possible. We did build a middle class on jobs post-World War II when we had, when we dominated the world economy. We had unions and a strong manufacturing sector. We can't do that anymore. You know, we have a globalized economy. The jobs are good-paying jobs are not going to be here in America. Unions have
Let me just push back on that a little.
Yeah,
Germany is doing that successfully. Japan is doing that successfully. South Korea is doing that successfully. And China's doing that successfully. And the way that they do it is with the functional equivalent of how we used to do it successfully, which is tariffs. Only instead of tariffs, what they do is they have a value-added tax that adds up to somewhere between 15 and 20%, depending on which one of those countries you're talking about. And then they reverse that tax out when they export. So, and they add that tax on when people try to import. So they have a barrier to imports, and they have an incentive for exports. And were we to do something rational like that, we would have a rational trade policy. But we're not. That's not going to happen because the transnational corporations are pulling the strings here in America. So back to your process.
So
but I didn't want to just kind of leave that out there that there's nothing that can be done, because there actually is a lot that could be done.
Okay, granted. But what I'm saying is this: if we want to have a middle class, there's another way to do it other than to try to swim against the tide and base it on jobs. And that is to base it on non-labor income. This is what the rich do. They get all their income pretty much not from the sweat of their brow or the genius of their brain, but from owning lots of claims on income, property rights, and banks and all that financial stuff. That's how the rich get rich. And that's all right. I mean, we won't go to that. But what I'm saying is that the middle class needs its own source of non-labor income. And what I am proposing is that there's all this wealth out there, this common wealth that really belongs to all of us. Part of the way the rich get rich is that they just take a lot of that wealth or we give it to them for free. So what I'm saying is let's put a real price on that wealth and let's...
For example, what is that wealth?
Give it to ourselves. Well, first of all, Alaska does this with oil. Oil wealth, that's kind of obvious, and it's limited and so forth. But right. Way beyond oil, there are all the other gifts of nature that at the moment we don't consider wealth, but they really are, such as clean air. And we've got all these polluters, you know, big corporations that do all sorts of polluting. We pollute ourselves, but so what? Just dumping all this crap into the air, our air, for free. So if we set up some sort of a trust to manage the air on our behalf and on behalf of future generations, they would put a price on polluting. And there are various ways you could implement that price, collect the money, and so forth. That would diminish pollution, and then there'd be this revenue stream, which would be paid out equally as dividends to all of us.
It's kind of like a variation on cap and trade, only instead of giving the banksters the money, we ourselves keep the money. And
precisely.
And when you mentioned the Alaska Permanent Fund, just to clarify for our listeners and viewers who may not know what you're talking about, and I think probably most of them do, but still, just very quickly, in Alaska, they say, you know, that oil under the ground is ours, and if you're going to take that oil, you are going to pay us a chunk of that. And everybody in the state of Alaska every year, and that money that the state gets then goes into a fund, the Alaska Permanent Fund, which invests the money in everything from treasury bills to the stock market, and then pays out dividends to its stockholders, which is every single person in Alaska. So if you're a family of five, you get five $2,000 checks, you know. I don't know how many kids Sarah Palin has, but it's like, you know, it's like the more kids you got, the more money you get. And that's one of the reasons why Alaska has, I think you pointed out in your article, the second lowest rate of income inequality, and there was one other stat associated with that.
Yeah, it had the third highest median income, you know,
in the nation.
The middle person, yes, of all
right.
states.
And because that annual $1,000, $2,000 check helps bring up the bottom, basically, the people who are working on minimum wage and things. And so instead of saying, okay, we're going to, and frankly, I think we should be doing this with our oil. We should be doing it with all of our, you know, timber, everything that's being taken off federal land, and put it into a fund. And did you know that Thomas Paine suggested this in 1797?
I did, in fact, know that. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Tom Paine, and I know you are, too.
In agrarian justice, yeah. It's something very similar to this, actually,
right.
Yeah.
So this is not a new idea. This is hundreds of years old, and nobody's, like, more patriotic than Tom Paine.
You bet. So
and this is not, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is not income redistribution. It's just a fair distribution of what is rightfully ours.
Right. The other
There's
point
no
that you made that I thought was
forgetting this.
That I thought was brilliant is that when I create a corporation, or anybody creates a corporation, I get certain benefits that I don't have as an individual, but my corporation has the, you know, access to the courts, certain tax advantages. There's all kinds of benefits that you can get from incorporating, and big corporations get these benefits and use them, the court system, a stable money system, our banking system, and all of this, and you know, arguably, you could even extend this out. The oil industry gets our military for free, you know, to protect their shipping lanes. Why don't we start charging for this stuff and put that into the American Permanent Fund?
Yep, I think that's the program. I mean, it addresses really the two major issues that we face in the 21st century.
Isn't the corporate income tax another way of charging for these things, though?
Well, it is, but A, they don't pay for it, and, I mean, they don't pay very much, and B, you know, they get a lot of that back in a lot of the benefits that government gives them that it
right.
doesn't give for the 99%.
And it also doesn't make it clear to Americans why corporations are paying taxes, that they're using our commons.
Exactly, and this is not just about paying taxes to government and then having government do things, good or bad. This is about just our rightful sharing of wealth that belongs to us. It's almost beyond government.
This is the commonwealth, as they call the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of the founders understood this, Peter Burns. Peter Burns, you can read it on thecommons.org is his website, and his book Capitalism 3.0. Peter, thanks for dropping by today.
All right, Tom.
And thanks for getting out your great ideas. It's a marvelous one. We will be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, Greece today, they signed off on this thing. This is going to be a disaster. I'll tell you about that. And Franklin Graham, Obama's secretly a Muslim? Really?
They want to get my
And just a quick update on what we're going to be doing throughout the rest of the day. Eric Beiler from Coffee Party USA. There's going to be a flash rally at the Supreme Court this week. We'll tell you about that in about a half hour. And Mark Williams, the former chair of the Tea Party Express, is going to be with us at the top of the next hour. He's got some stories to tell us about how the Tea Party is going to play a major role in the coming election. They're planning on keeping their power and expanding it. And Carrie Lucas, the managing director of the Independent Women's Forum, will be with us in our third hour to talk about this whole hoop-de-doop about Daryl Issa and his hearings and women's reproductive rights and the Virginia law and whatnot. These are conversations we need to be having as conversations, not as slap-down screaming matches. In the meantime, speaking of slap-down screaming matches, Franklin Graham, who was uninvited recently from one particular Christian gig, he was on MSNBC apparently this morning. I didn't see it, but he said he was asked, "Is President Obama a Christian?" And he said, "I can't answer that question for anybody." But then when he was asked if Rick Santorum was a Christian, "Oh yeah, absolutely." And in fact, when asked if Obama was a Christian, he even went farther than that. I mean, he went completely off the rail, frankly. He said, and I quote, "Islam sees him as a son of Islam because his father was a Muslim, his grandfather was a Muslim, his great-grandfather was a Muslim, and so under Islamic law, the Muslim world sees Barack Obama as a Muslim." Right. I guarantee you the Muslim world does not see Barack Obama as a Muslim. If they did, they probably wouldn't be shooting at our troops. And secondly, although I don't want to say that it's purely a religious war, people don't like their countries being occupied. But B, then he said he could not rule out the possibility that Obama may secretly be a Muslim. He said, "I can't say categorically that Obama is not a Muslim because Islam has gotten a free pass under Obama." And this, like, you know, the Morning Joe guys are just, really? And Willie Geist said, "So you think Rick Santorum is a Christian?" Graham says, "Yeah, I think so. Why is it different for Santorum?" "Well, because his values are so clear on moral issues." "Oh, really? President Obama is the guy who says, let's feed the hungry? Rick Santorum says, hey, you're on your own? Jesus said, let's feed the hungry. Who's the Christian? President Obama says, let's heal the sick, all of the sick. Rick Santorum says, hey, if you're sick, you're on your own, should be privatized. Jesus said, heal the sick. Who's the Christian? Obama said we should house the homeless, clothe the naked, basically. Rick Santorum says, that's not the role of government. If you're homeless, you're on your own. Jesus said, house the homeless. Clothe the naked," actually, was literally what he said in Matthew 25. Today's version of that would be, house the homeless. I just find this astounding. And then he goes off on Mitt Romney. Alex Wagner says, "Reverend, what about Mitt Romney? Is he a Christian?" Graham says, "He's a Mormon. Most Christians would not recognize Mormons as part of the Christian faith." And then he says, "And I think Newt is a Christian." So it's like, who appointed this guy leader of the Christian world? In the world of Catholicism, the Pope can speak for the Catholics, but the rest of the Christian world doesn't have a spokesperson. What they have, you know, what you have are individual leaders of individual sects. I'm guessing that probably Billy or Franklin Graham. First of all, I don't think his father would, his comments about Jews to Richard Nixon notwithstanding, I don't think that his father would have done or said this. I think that Franklin Graham has gone way off the right wing crazy train in ways that if his father Billy Graham. I used to, watch Billy. I watched him on TV. I never went to one, but I watched several of Billy Graham's telethons, whatever he called them back in the day, back in the 60s. And he was all about, the core stuff of religion, not about politics. And here's this guy trying to insert himself into politics. I mean, it's just incredible. Okay, meanwhile, the whole the gas prices, this is the other thing that's all over the news right now. Gas prices are going up. They're averaging around $3.60 a gallon right now in the United States. Consider something for a moment. Demand for gasoline right now in the United States is lower than it has been since 2007. Demand is lower. We are exporting more gasoline than any other product. It's our number one export. Just 12 years ago, we were importing gasoline. So we have a surplus of gasoline. What do the oil companies do? Do they sell it at a lower price? Do they compete with each other in the United States? And say, hey, ExxonMobil says to Shell, I'm going to compete with you on price. We're going to drop the price of our gasoline. No, they export it. Drive down the supply. Even though demand is lower than it had been, they export it, thus raising the domestic prices. So in particular, domestic oil companies, you know, the Koch brothers, for example, they're making out great. And special bonus, if you can get the gas price above $4 a gallon, Americans are going to be really upset. And who are they going to be upset with? Well, typically the president is the guy that they get upset with, because most Americans think that the president has control over this somehow. And this is right after the American Petroleum Institute had said that they would exact a political price if Obama didn't sign off the Keystone XL pipeline. Coincidence?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As my old friend and co-author Lamar Waldron used to say, coincidence or conspiracy?
Thank God for all I miss. Cause it led me here to this.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is a fascinating one. Over at Talking Points Memo, Shahil Kapoor, who is the congressional reporter for TPM, is writing that Chief Justice John Roberts may not want to rule on whether Obamacare is constitutional, whether, you know, the individual mandate part is constitutional in this court session. That he may want to put it off until 2014, and that there's some significant evidence that that's what's going on, because he doesn't, basically, the theory is that John Roberts doesn't want the Supreme Court. After the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court has become such a political football, a pinata is what Shahil calls it, and that John Roberts doesn't want it to go any farther. And striking down or upholding Obamacare in, you know, this summer, in an election year, would be perceived as a political act by the court. And so he's going to try and put it off for 2 years. How can he do that? What's the legal justification? Well, there's this law called the Anti-Injunction Act, which was passed way back long ago and far away. I'm going to have to track that one down. I'm guessing it's probably somebody in our chat room will track it down and let us know when it was passed. And what the Anti-Injunction Act says is that the courts cannot block a tax which is not yet being collected. So if Congress passes a law to collect a tax, say in 1880, but the tax doesn't begin until 1890, then the Supreme Court or any court can't really rule on that tax until 1890. And in fact, one of the inferior courts, one of the appeals courts that decided not to strike down Obamacare did so based on the Anti-Injunction Act. They said, you know, we don't have jurisdiction here. We don't have any right to rule on this because the tax doesn't begin until 2014. 2014 is the year when, if you don't have health insurance, the government will provide it to you and charge you a fee for it, which you actually don't have to pay, but you're supposed to pay. And the Obama administration is arguing, because you don't have to pay it, you just are supposed to pay it, it's not actually a tax. And the various plaintiffs against Obamacare are saying, yeah, it is a tax. And Obama's and the Obama administration say, no, it's a fee. And that's different from a tax. And so both sides, both the Obama administration and the plaintiffs, the ones who want to strike down Obamacare, they're both saying, because this is not a tax, the Anti-Injunction Act has nothing to do with this. So John Roberts just, apparently yesterday or the day before, moved the time for oral arguments from 5.5 to 6 hours, allocating 1.5 hours out of the total 6 hours just to debate the Anti-Injunction Act, which is the Supreme Court's backdoor wiggle room. Oh, we don't have to talk about this for 2 more years. So there's not going to be any more court bashing, because I have a feeling it's reaching the point now where Roberts and Scalia and Thomas and some of these guys are like afraid to show up in public. And even though neither of the neither the Obama administration or the three, you know, right wing states and attorneys general or whatever who are suing to stop Obamacare, none of them say it's a tax and therefore the Anti-Injunction Act. Therefore, Justice Roberts has appointed expert lawyers, two veteran attorneys. To quote Shahil Kapoor's piece in TPM today, the High Court has appointed two veteran attorneys to argue that it does. So just like with Citizens United, originally the court was supposed to decide this very, very narrow little slice of whether or not McCain-Feingold was constitutional. They heard the arguments. And then after they heard the arguments, this is 2009, after they heard the arguments, they came back, or 2008, I think it was, they came back and they said, you know, come back and argue it again next year. We're not going to make a decision right now. Come back and argue it again next year, only in a much broader context. And then they issued this incredibly sweeping knockdown of the Tillman Act all the way back to 1907. I mean, they just wrote law from the bench in ways that was, you know, arguably more expansive than anything since Roe v. Wade. And they're taking a lot of flack for it. And so I think that Shahil Kapoor is onto something here. And this would be a very fascinating one. Okay, I told you about what Franklin Graham said. Here's actually what he said.
Do you believe that President Obama is a Christian?
Well, I think you have to ask President Obama. You can ask me, do I believe you're a Christian? I think the best thing for a person is to ask you directly. So I think people have to ask Barack Obama. He's come out saying that he's a Christian. So I think the question is, what is a Christian?
So you don't take him at his word when he says, I'm a Christian?
No, of course I do. Well, I was saying, you have to ask every person, but he has said he's a Christian, so I just have to assume, you know, that he is.
So therefore, by your definition, he's not a Christian.
I mean, again, you have to ask him. I cannot answer that question for anybody.
And then this.
Do you believe that Rick Santorum is Christian?
Oh, I think so.
So how do you know? If the standard is only the person knows what's within him, when you apply it to the president, why is it different for Rick Santorum?
Well, because his values are so clear on moral issues. No question about it.
Mm-hmm. And you have one more, Jacob? Here it is.
Reverend, what about Mitt Romney?
I like him.
Is he a Christian?
He's a Mormon.
But he's said that he's part of the Judeo-Christian faith. Do you take him at his
word? But most Christians would not recognize Mormonism as part of the Christian faith.
So he is not a Christian.
I'm just saying most Christians would not recognize Mormonism.
Yeah. You know, I think Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, even John Adams, all of those guys must be rolling over in their graves that we're having debates about religion in the context of our presidential campaign. Article 5, I believe it is, of the Constitution explicitly says there shall be no religious test for holders of public office. None. Why can't we be as smart as the founders? Anyhow, to your thoughts, Alexander in Alabaster, Alabama. Hey, Alexander, what's up?
All right. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Listen, I want to talk about the fact how oil companies are able to manipulate the public so badly. You know, back in 1940, Shell had the scientists, and they got this on video where these scientists got together and created some chemicals to the gasoline where automobiles were able to get from 80 to over 100 miles off a gallon of gasoline. Mm-hmm. And yet they keep this technology locked behind closed doors and just won't release it, even in hard times.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but thank you, Alexander, for the call. But I do know that the gasoline companies, you know, we're producing more gas. There is a glut of gasoline in the United States. Our demand is lower than it's been since 2007, and we have so much extra gasoline in this country that it has become our number one export. But the gas companies, rather than competing with each other by selling it, by lowering price, because they've got so much extra, they're exporting it. It has become our number one export. They're doing that, in my opinion, to maintain high gas prices. Zach in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Zach, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I was just calling because I've hated politics. I'm only 35. I've hated politics forever and never really followed it, but until all this financial mess. And last night they were running the President Clinton on the American Experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to show that the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's all the same garbage. They were dealing with the exact same things in 94, 92. It's like, when does this madness stop?
Which particular madness are you referring to?
I don't... It showed Gingrich trying to go after Clinton for all of the economic stuff. I mean, they even showed the debates of the people that were out of work and the recession. It's like I just want to call and voice my frustration because it just doesn't seem the madness doesn't end. And I really wish people would start calling the right wing the Reich wing because they are. Their ideology is the exact same.
Zach, you know, the madness is going to end when Americans start getting aggressively involved. And I, you know, part of me thinks that that's going to take something like a Great Depression. I hope not. I hope that more people wake up. I hope more people get involved. I hope more people participate. But you're right. You know, Ronald Reagan had, in after he dropped the top tax rate, like crazy, he dropped it from 74% down to 50% in 82. In 81. And what did that produce? In 1982, we had the highest unemployment we had had since the Great Depression. Unemployment was at 12% during the Reagan administration. People forget that. And then in 96, he dropped the top tax rate down to 25%, which produced this wild speculative bubble. He had deregulated the SNLs 3 years earlier. The SNLs crashed and burned. And people forget that too. And he also had the greatest stock market crash that year in the history of the United States, except for during the 1929. And, again, it was Reaganomics. And then he borrowed three times. He tripled the national debt. He borrowed more money than every president since George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. And when you add him to George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush, they borrowed twice as much money as all the other presidents combined. And somehow we've forgotten that, too. Zach, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, man, this is... By the way, the New York Police Department spying on Muslim students going whitewater rafting with them. Isn't that cute? Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Eric Beiler is with us. He's the co-founder of the Coffee Party. Coffee Party USA is .com is their website. The flip side of the Tea Party, I suppose. In fact, Mark Williams, the Tea Party Express, will be with us right after the top of the hour. But Eric Beiler is with us. And Eric, you've got something. First of all, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And you've got something coming up. Tell us about it.
Well, on Thursday at 12 noon at the Supreme Court, we are going to be having a flash rally to support the idea of revisiting Citizens United. I'm sure many of your listeners are aware that this Supreme Court of Montana ruled to uphold a century-old law that banned corporations from spending money to influence elections
right.
in Montana.
The Montana Corrupt Practices Act.
Right. Now, on Friday, late Friday, the Supreme Court issued a stay on that law, which means it won't be enforced until or unless the Supreme Court decides to hear arguments on this law and possibly revisit Citizens United. And Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer made this very courageous, unusual step of essentially painting a pathway for Citizens United to be reversed based on the arguments that this Attorney General of Montana could make. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to show that the court of public opinion has already decided that the Citizens United decision was a horrendous, bad decision, and that it's negatively impacting our elections, but not only our elections, the laws that we're making are being polluted and warped by the influence of money in politics.
Yeah. Now, here's my concern, Eric. And so the flash mob at the Supreme Court on Thursday at, do I have that right?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be a mob, but we're inviting people to use their creativity to express how they feel about this law, whether it be a sign. We're going to have some satirical songs. We're going to have some people dressing up in costumes. It's just going to be on your lunch hour from 12 to 12:45. But we want to sort of move the conversation from all of this frustration and disgust over the Republican super PAC primary.
Right.
Which is very much related to this,
yep.
But people are only focused on the outcome of elections. But, you know, your listeners, the people who work with Coffee Party, Common Cause, and Free Speech for People are involved in this. The people who organize with us, we understand that it's an issue of the policy that comes from a corrupt Congress that's influenced by money. So it's not just about whether Santorum or Romney is the nominee or whether it ends up being Santorum or Obama that's president. The system is corrupt, and we have to address it. And so we need to move this national conversation. It's great we're talking about Sheldon Adelson and all that stuff, but we need to move that conversation to the root of the problem, and the root of the problem is money in politics. If we can actually produce very rapidly in the social media era, I think it's possible, produce the kind of cultural shift like we saw with the SOPA PIPA pushback, mm-hmm. that influences the Supreme Court to say, you know, 2 years ago we said that it probably wouldn't create the perception of corruption if we allow unlimited anonymous spending by corporate entities and other special interests to influence mm-hmm. our elections. Well, now we have more information. We have a second chance to look at this.
Yeah.
So let's allow oral arguments and let's put this case and this question on the national stage. I think
here's,
it would be a great.
Here's my fear, Eric,
uh-huh.
And that is that the Supreme Court will revisit Citizens United and that they'll calibrate their decision down a little bit and say, okay, super PACs are not allowed and some of the McCain-Feingold exemptions can come in, but we still think that corporations are people and money is speech. But by doing that, by taking the most egregious pieces out, they will leave intact a corporate power structure and a billionaire power structure, and they will also take steam out of the movement to amend the Constitution to say to the Supreme Court, sorry, guys, corporations are not people and money is not speech. You know, Bilotti was wrongly decided. Buckley was wrongly decided. Citizens United was wrongly decided. And you know, that the court actually might successfully blow up the movement to amend the Constitution.
Well, yeah, there are people who are working, and actually Coffee Party is also working with the Move to Amend Coalition to pass the constitutional amendment that money is not speech and that corporations are not people. And I'm not sure what will happen if they actually allow this case to come before them. But I think that what's exciting is that in this new era of social media, the people don't really know our own strength. I think we've realized that the shackle is off our ankle, but we just don't know what happens if we actually start to walk.
Yeah,
and so,
like the baby elephants.
Exactly. It's like the baby.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we no longer are defined by the radius of that chain, right? Where we can walk is no longer defined by the radius of what 1% media defines for us. We now can define the conversation. And when we do that, we can move, what was it, 40 senators who backed away from SOPA PIPA in one day because 8 million of us expressed our opinion on whether we wanted the government or whatever it is.
But the SOPA PIPA victory, I look at that and I think, well, that was great. But you also had several multi-billion dollar corporations fighting that. Google was out there. Wikipedia was out there on the side of SOPA PIPA not passing. And so it was a victory of sorts, but it was also, one group of giant corporations fighting another group of giant corporations, and the people sided with one of the groups of giant corporations. I don't see that with campaign finance reform.
Well, just on the Sopapipa thing, that was the 20th century corporations versus the 21st century, right? I look at Google and Facebook as tools. Wikipedia is a tool that everyday Americans can pick up. Most of us can afford to have internet access and use Wikipedia or Google or Facebook. The old model from the 20th century, where it's Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and all these 1% media outlets, that one-way conversation, that was the problem. We have a whole new doorway that's open because we have these read-write conversations, two-way conversations, and the people can have conversations with each other now that aren't dictated by the 1%'s framing. So that's why I want to test this out. I feel like we're in a boxing match with a stronger fighter, and that this corporate behemoth is let its guard down. And our plan was to try to last 15 rounds and pass the constitutional amendment 5 years from now. But right now, we can wind up and take a punch and hit this corporate behemoth, the Citizens United decision, right in the face and educate a lot of Americans in the process. So come out at noon on Thursday, United States Supreme Court. We're going to be there for an hour from noon to one. Take your lunch with us.
That's great. Okay. Thank you very much. Eric Beiler, co-founder of the Coffee Party, USA.com. And check it out. Check out the website. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we're seeing this really rather remarkable political bizarre show going on where enormous, mind-boggling amounts of money are being spent by various billionaires to prop up various Republican candidates. And it kind of makes it look like there's no grassroots support for any of these guys. There's just, you know, there's Foster Freeze for Rick Santorum, and there's Shelley Adelson for Newt Gingrich, and there's John Paulson for Mitt Romney, and in fact, all of them, the vast majority of the money that they're spending is, or that is being spent on their behalf, is coming from a small handful of fewer than 20 billionaires. But that said, you know, where is the Tea Party? What's going on with the Tea Party? Where have they gone? What do they have up their sleeve? Let's check in with a guy who would know. And that would be Mark Williams, the former chair of the Tea Party Express, conservative talk show host and author. His website, marktalk.com. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Always fun, Tom.
Hey, thank you. So you say not only is the Tea Party still relevant, but it's driving the civil war in the Republican Party. Yesterday I was sharing with my listeners and viewers some clips from the Concord Coalition's website where they were teaching Tea Partiers how to become precinct committee men in the Republican Party, how to take over the Republican Party from within. And you guys did it. And, you know, I salute you. I mean, you pulled off the takeover of a major political party, and I wish progressives would do the same thing with the Democratic Party. And in fact, they are in many areas. But don't you think that given these fairly public fights between John Boehner and Eric Cantor, Cantor representing the Tea Party wing, Boehner representing the old established Republican wing, that the cracks are starting to show in the Tea Party front?
Actually, no. The cracks that are and the fissures in the Tea Party have always been in there. It's built in. Anytime you get, you know, several million people all thinking on their own, you're going to have differences. But the Tea Parties are moving in a completely different direction. Just this past weekend, I emceed and spoke at a gathering of representatives from seven different San Francisco Bay Area and Sacramento Area Tea Party groups, each with different priorities, but all with the same fundamental issue, and that is, come November 2012, Barack Obama and the progressive agenda have got to be thrown out of Washington.
Right.
So they're refocusing on that effort, and you're right, across the country, and one of the bastions, one of the strongholds of this movement has, ironically enough, become San Francisco. We're taking over local Republican organizations. We're taking over Republican Party apparatus, and we're finally, you know, it's finally sinking in to the establishment Republicans that they are as much of the problem as any Democrat or any big spending, whatever. This is America's people reaching out to grab back the controls of their government as they're supposed to, as they're supposed to have done. And I, for one, am employing the tactics that I was trained to use as a long-haired liberal in the streets of Boston in the 1970s. So, the progressives have been doing this for a very long time, and they do, in fact, control the Democrat Party. But either this
in my in your dreams, Mark, and mine too.
Well, this is where both progressives and conservatives have, I think, a common ground, and that is it's no longer become an ideological battle. It's no longer a battle between parties. This is a battle between the entitled, call it the 1%, if you will, those on the inside, and those of us who are the working stiffs who support this country, who support these 16 vacations in 3 years for Michelle Obama, the people who work hard so that a tiny sliver at the top of the pyramid can live like kings and give our money to Wall Street. This is the American people taking their constitutional role, and it's being the pushback is unbelievable.
I'm curious, the venue that you spoke at, where in San Francisco, where did you speak?
It was a town called Fairfield. It was a very large Tea Party organization. They've got their own building, and we had people from all over the Bay Area. We probably had 50 or 60 people in the room from seven different groups.
Uh-huh. Who paid for it?
You know, cross-pollinated.
Who paid for it?
And there are gatherings like this taking place all around the country. And these are not for-profit. These aren't like the old Tea Party Nation convention idea.
Right.
These are people who actually take time off of work and drive for it.
But this is not a gotcha question. It's a genuine curiosity, because I know a lot of the Tea Party activities that we saw in the United States, you had $350,000 custom-painted buses paid for by multimillionaire Dick Armey and FreedomWorks. With various Tea Party organization logos.
We were prohibited from taking anything more than $5,000, and we weren't allowed to take corporate or other PAC donations. We had to, because we were set up as a 501.
So this organization that owns its own building is not being funded by one of the Koch brothers or Dick Armey or something like that?
No, they passed the hat.
The
building owner was nice enough to donate the building rent-free.
I see. Okay. So, you know, that kind of thing, that grassroots kind of stuff is the stuff that, you know, I applaud. I don't understand why you think that if government is no longer having regulations that keep our air clean, for example, that somehow our air is going to get clean. And
nobody suggests that they'd be eliminated. What we're talking about is balance and reasonableness. It's when you have official government lunch inspectors in North Carolina checking kids' bag lunches, and when you a story like you had at the top of the hour of an official state probe before a woman can have an abortion, that's when government's gone way too far.
Mark, you know that story about the lunches was exaggerated and blown out of proportion by Fox News. It turned out that the school lunch lady offered the kid who had brought a bag lunch to also have a free lunch at the school. She said, I can give you a little more if you'd like it. And somehow that got turned into on the blogosphere on the right of, you know, lunch bag inspectors, which is nonsense.
Sure. Then a second kid came forward. So, yeah, I'm sure we'll hear more about that. But the point is the same one you were making at the top of the hour about the official government uterus inspector. The government has gone way too far. And here's conservative Herb Perry in Texas with the sonogram law. If you go in for an abortion, you have to have a sonogram, and they make you look at it. That's ridiculous. That is overstepping the bounds of government. And that's what this is about. It's not about eliminating government. We have absolutely a need for government, absolutely a need for regulatory action, but we don't need half this country not paying taxes. We don't need a tiny elite at the top of the pyramid served and supported by a semi-elite workforce, and the rest of us on the bottom of the pyramid slaving away in the salt mine.
So before the Bush Great Depression, 39% of Americans were not paying federal income taxes because they lived in poverty. Now it's 47% because of Bush's policies and 30 years of Reaganomics.
Tea Partiers and conservatives, when they look at Willard Milquetoast Romney.
Why do you want those people who are making $15,000, $20,000, $12,000 a year, Walmart greeters? They're already paying 13% Social Security and Medicare tax. You know, they're paying the payroll tax. They're paying they're paying sales taxes, they're paying fees, they're paying for their driver's license, they're paying to register their car, they're paying all those things. Why do you want to hit them with a federal income tax also?
They should be paying their fair share like the rest of us.
Don't you think that they're if somebody is living in poverty that they are paying their fair share by virtue of the fact that they're being basically exploited by the corporate system?
Well, we're all paying those taxes. We're all paying those fees. And we all have to pay our fair share. I mean, that has been the mantra.
So you want somebody who's living in poverty to be in even greater poverty?
Do you also
want to maintain the 15% tax, top maximum tax on dividends?
I think we should lower Warren Buffett's secretary's tax rate to the 15%. And I think everybody should pay their fair share.
Cut the taxes on the billionaires, raise the taxes on the poor.
Here's the difference, though. What you do, if people are going to be paying their fair share, they must also have the prospect for prosperity. And that means less regulation, better education, less state intervention.
So free college for everybody?
Board. Pardon me?
Free college for everybody? Like Lincoln suggested?
Possibly. I mean, California used to be free college.
Yeah,
I mean,
it did.
Nice if we had free college.
Okay, Mark, hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mark, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. MarkTalk.com. Mark Williams,
thank you.
Good talking with you. Taking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry in Washington, West Virginia. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It's me again. Honorably discharged, 73. The Tea Party makes the mistake of doing what so many do. The lies we tell ourselves do more disservice and damage than anything else we'll ever be running into.
Okay. Well, how is that? Why is that? Why is that, Larry?
They tell themselves lies. They follow false beliefs and build a house of cards upon it.
For example?
Any kind.
For example?
Well, some of that clip where Muslims, all monotheism. Polytheism is so much closer to the truth. And believe me, I don't believe in polytheism either.
Okay. All right. Larry, I got it. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see. Joanne in Chicago. Hey, Joanne, what's up?
Yes, hi, Mr. Hartman. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I'm quoting in regard to our buddy Rick Santorum, which I can't help stumbling and saying sanatorium.
He has now declared that global warming is somehow anti-Christian, the idea that global warming is real.
Yeah, he's really off the charts, this guy. You know, I'm a Roman Catholic. I find him very offensive. He is seriously very misled and ignorant of church doctrine because he doesn't know and should be informed that in 1958, Pope Pius XII promulgated the very important encyclical called Social Justice.
Yeah.
The concept being we owe our neighbors, particularly those less fortunate, we owe them our time, our care, our resources. They must be implemented to come to the aid of those less fortunate fellow humans.
Yes.
And this is doctrine. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's not an option. It's not, I want to believe it. It might be true. It isn't. It is doctrine. It's a mandate.
If you're Catholic.
In the 1950s, when I was in grammar school, the nuns beat this into our heads, the concept of social justice as promulgated by this pope. And the second thing, they beat it into our heads that church and state are separate.
Yeah. Yeah. And
this guy is ignorant, and therefore he is arrogant.
Yeah.
Ignorant precedes arrogant. He waxes arrogant relevant to the church teaching. He doesn't have a clue. Someone needs to expose Santorum as the charlatan and fraud that he is.
Well, Joanne, I think you just did, and thank you very much for the call. And Mark Taylor Canfield from Seattle, you got an Occupy update from Occupy Seattle?
Yes, I do, Tom. Olympia, Washington has become the first city in the nation to host a major national Occupy Movement conference.
Okay.
And folks can read about it at my Huffington Post article and at Free Speech Radio News, but in general, the corporate news media did a total media blackout on it.
Yep.
But I think it was a great success. And it was truly a historical moment because it was the first time that there were delegations from Occupy groups from all over the country, including the original Occupy Wall Street group in New York City, you know, to get together and kind of try to figure out where we're going to go from here. There was actually a train that came up from California that they began to refer to as the Occupy Express because it had so many activists.
So where are you going to go from here?
Conference. Well, that was one of the questions that were put to the keynote speakers, like David, economist David Corton and my friend and Occupy Seattle member, Dorley Rainey. And after 3 days of events and dozens of meetings, there were the main thing that came out of it, I think, is that, and that was the purpose of the whole conference, was to try to unify the movement and try to develop some kind of national coordination and outreach so that all these hundreds of local Occupy groups can coalesce into one national Occupy movement.
Right.
And I think it's been a very good step, and it's very clear that the Occupy movement is not going away. It's just getting more focused on our objectives and strategy. So same issues, you know, home foreclosures, abuse of power and corruption on Wall Street and in Washington, D.C. It's still directed towards big banks and issues like, you know, student loans, health care, workers' rights, the environment.
Creating a more egalitarian society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, to quote our former two-term governor here in Washington State, you know, our job is to keep the rich from impoverishing the poor because the rich can take care of themselves. So I think the 99% are unified on that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's time for people to get really organized in this movement, though, because we have been criticized in the past for, you know, not really knowing what we were doing. But I think that, you know, we're very educated. It's a very educated movement, and it's a very open and widespread movement. And I think, you know, this conference will help it go on from here. And there will be more. There's already a Midwest conference that's scheduled for March in St. Louis. So
Mark, I've got to move along, but a lot of information there. Thank you for the update. I appreciate the call, and great to hear from you. Phil in Palm Harbor, Florida. Hey, Phil, minute to the break. What's up?
Oh, I'll have to talk fast. First of all, I wish I could have wrung that guy's neck. I worked during Christmas for a part-time job.
You mean Mark Taylor Canfield? Mark Williams.
No.
The Tea Party guy.
Yeah, okay. I had a part-time job during the Christmas working in a department store, and I paid taxes, and I'm looking at, let's see, where is it here? Federal withholding tax, $11.73 out of earnings of $300. I paid federal withholding tax.
Right. Yeah, although you may get it back next year when you file if you were below the threshold.
Yeah, get it back. You know, in 8 months. But the point is, first of all, that's a lie that we don't pay federal withholding tax.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, I can't understand why no one has asked the question, why can't Exxon and the rest of them build a refinery in Michigan or Minnesota to bring that oil for processing?
They already are. They already have. They have refineries in Ohio, Indiana, and Missouri. And there is a pipeline. There's already a Keystone XL pipeline coming from the tar sands in Alberta that goes to and terminates in Indiana. And they got refineries across the Midwest. And in fact, the latest study shows that if they build refineries down south, prices for gas in the Midwest will go up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your calls and thoughts and some of mine on the news of the day. Oh, amazing. I've got a Dominic Strauss con alert coming up. Stick around for this one. Well, this is absolutely fascinating. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Mitt Romney, who has been running campaign ads saying that Rick Santorum is as pro-labor as Barack Obama. Like, that's a slur, right? And, in fact, Rick Santorum is very anti-labor. The AFL-CIO has given him, like, a 17%, you know, voting score when he was a senator. I mean, Rick Santorum pretty much hates labor unions. It's like, you know, what? Democracy in the workplace? That's an insane notion. You can't have that. The fat cat should run the show. The people like Foster Freeze, who funds my campaign. Yeah, that's Rick Santorum's position. So anyhow, Romney in Michigan earlier today came out and said, and I quote, labor unions play an important role in our society. So they're an important part of America's economy. Excuse me. This is incredible. Whether this is going to scare away all of the Republicans or not, I don't frankly know. Whether it's going to make the Tea Party people, you know, hair on fire, go screaming out of the room, I don't know. Or if they're just going to say, you know, Mitt's saying whatever he's got to say to get elected. The fact of the matter is, when he was governor of Massachusetts, he did support the police union, and they described him as being pro-labor. So, but on the other hand, that's kind of what he had to do to get elected. So maybe he's just a pragmatist who just likes power. Maybe he's just trying to fill his daddy's shoes. His dad was governor of Michigan and tried to be president unsuccessfully. Mitt was governor of Massachusetts, and now he's trying to be president. And boy, would Sigmund Freud have fun with that, right? Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Charles in Oakawaka, Illinois. Do I have that right?
Hello?
Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, I was wanting to know if there isn't an election because of war with Iran, and won't the Supreme Court justices give Obama and all the other incumbents another run-through? And if the Obama's a Muslim and he comes out with a mark of the beast, won't he be a Muslim prophet then? And wouldn't that make him a king of the world?
Are these rhetorical funny questions, or have you been watching Glenn Beck?
No, I've been watching the government, and I've watched them give out presidential dedications and awards, and Obama got a
There's going to be no suspension of the election, Charles. We were fighting World War II, and we had a presidential election.
Structured government later on.
Charles, okay, you may know that. I don't know that. I don't believe that. I know that there's, you know, some guys. I know some guys in Michigan who've got a whole bunch of guns and a whole bunch of food, and they're convinced the whole thing's going down the tubes, and they're ready. But, you know, they're going to be disappointed. Judy in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hey, Judy, what's up?
I was just listening to some guy the other morning talk about how the American public generally is pretty stupid and ignorant as far as politics are concerned, and they're proud of it in spite of everything. To the contrary, they'll vote against their own best interests, and it doesn't make any difference what the Democrats say or what the progressives say or what the 99%ers say. They will vote against their own best self-interest.
Yeah. Well, and this is Judy, thank you. And there's a certain amount of reality to that. And what it is that people are being cleaved. They're being peeled off by the far right on a whole variety of issues. God's gays, guns, things like that. And frankly, you know, part of the word we need to get out is that, you know, Bernie Sanders has a 100% voting record with the NRA. I mean, I believe it's very high anyway. Vermont has very, very liberal gun laws. It's a very rural state. Guns are not a problem in Vermont. So, you know, he's representing his people. And there's a pro-life, Democrats for Life group. I mean, this is not necessarily partisan, but the Republicans are doing their best to make it partisan. And so, anyway, Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Leonard, what's up? Okay, Leonard, you got to listen to the phone a little better. Peter in Blaine, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to draw your attention to something that happened right here in Blaine on Friday. There was a fire at the BP refinery, which is just like 4 miles from my house.
Ouch.
And fortunately, it wasn't a really bad fire and nobody was hurt, and they got it knocked down in like an hour. But now the talk from BP is that, well, they aren't going to be able to process crude for something like 6 months at least. And that, you know, the price of gasoline is going to go up like, you know, 50, 60 cents a gallon, at least locally. I don't know what the, you know, national
Very interesting.
Implications are.
Very interesting.
But It seems a little phony to me, I have to say. I have a good friend who works there, and he agrees with me. I mean, it just involved one tower of this huge complex that's the biggest refinery in Washington.
Right.
And yet they're saying that they got to shut down the whole crude processing.
Well, this is like what Enron did, you know, when Gray Davis was governor of California and they wanted to take him out and replace him with a good Republican. And Ken Lay had this private meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger at, I believe it was the Beverly Hills Hotel, or one of those hotels, a secret meeting with him. And then they started these rolling blackouts across California, shutting down power plants and jacking up the price that California had to pay for electricity. And, you know, just it was shock therapy, as it were, to the people of California. And so the people of California rose up and bumped, you know, knocked out Gray Davis. Daryl Issa put $1 million of his own money into that. You recall the Gray Davis campaign, thinking that he would be the next governor. And then when he discovered that Ken Lay had secretly, you know, rigged the game so that Schwarzenegger could come in, he on television, he broke down and cried. I mean, it was just an amazing spectacle. But, yeah, it may well be. I mean, the oil companies... The head of their lobbyists came out and said, if Obama's not going to give us the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, we're going to take him down politically. And the way that they do that is by jacking up gas prices. And the way they do that is by shutting down refinery capacity and exporting gasoline. And it sounds like they're doing both. Thanks for the heads up, Peter. I appreciate it. Scott in Boquilla, Florida. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, you got it right. Thanks, Tom. Well, as you probably know, I'm in Florida, and last week we were able to defeat the Senate bill to privatize the prisons here in Florida, 21-19.
Yeah, you had eight or nine Republicans who jumped over on the side of what's right and good. That was a remarkable thing.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. I don't think any of them were Tea Party people, but they did come our way, and it's because there are Republicans that care about the people in their district.
Yep.
But now the new thing is this Senate bill 2106. Is trying to cut the minimum that employers have to pay their tipped employees in Florida from $4.65 an hour to $2.13 an hour. And not only is that onerous and hard on waitresses, many of whom are single mothers and waiters, but it probably flies in the face of the Florida Constitution, which mandates that they can only take a tip credit of $3.02. Against whatever the Florida minimum wage is, which is currently $7.67 an hour, which pegs it at $4.65 an hour. And as you know, we're pretty well buried in Koch brothers and ALEC legislation down here. The most recent one was by, you know, a representative named Rachel Bergen,
right,
who submitted some legislation from ALEC and left ALEC's name all over it when she submitted it to the legislature.
Yep, we
My question
on
to
it.
You is, I know, and my question to you is this ALEC legislation, too, this attempt to probably violate the Florida Constitution
and reduce the minimum wage?
What tip employees have to be paid?
Scott, I honestly don't know. The ALEC legislation is generally fairly well concealed. The way that you know that it's ALEC legislation is in retrospect. You look back, and when you see that, you know, over a six-month period, the same legislation was introduced in 15 different states by 15 different Republicans who all happened to be at one of the ALEC meetings, then, you know, bingo, the light goes off. So, you know, I honestly don't know and wouldn't hazard to guess. The philosophical underpinning of that kind of thing, which is that having a middle class is a bad thing because middle classes are unstable and therefore we need a large class of working poor. That's just core Republican philosophy and has been since the 1950s. Actually, arguably has been since the 1880s. And that's the direction that they're moving in. But, you know, I beyond that, I don't know. Thank you for the call, Scott. Virginia in Seattle. Hey, Virginia, got a minute to the break. A quick one?
Hi. I'd just like to mention that inflation is a tax.
It is.
A cruel tax on the poor. And when the cost of living didn't go up for a couple of years, it really hit us seniors hard.
You mean when the cost of living adjustments didn't go up, even though inflation did go up?
Yeah, the COLA.
I'm with you, and we have to, and this is something Bernie Sanders has been really fighting for, and I encourage people to go to his website at bernie.org. That's his campaign website, and help him out. He's a good guy who's going to need a lot of help, because he's up for re-election this year. Yeah, this bernie.org is different than his sanders.senate.gov site. That's his official, that's his Senate one. This is his kind of fundraising campaign site, bernie.org. But in any case, He has been pointing this out as well, and he's been saying, you know, why is it that the cost of living adjustment for Social Security includes things like advances in computer technology? You know, instead it should be things like food and medicine and transportation and housing, and just, you know, keep it at the core stuff. And he's fighting the good fight. We all need him out there. Virginia, thank you very much for the call. Much appreciated. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in on the Talk Radio News Service. And did you know that the Founding Fathers were broke, by and large? I got to share that story with you right after this. No, you can't. Will you just laugh? Maybe. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Are the Rolling Stones at the White House?
Mick Jagger will be there tonight.
Ah, okay.
It's my understanding is part of a celebration of blues.
Wow.
Yeah, it's all part of Black History Month. And where he fits into either one of those categories is beyond me. I probably need to double check, but I'm pretty sure he's going to be there.
Yeah.
I was never a fan.
Okay.
It's not my type, but more information you need.
Are you at the White House right now?
I'm in the basement.
Okay. So what's going on there?
Well, I just left Jay Carney's briefing, and even though it's a bit of a catnip story, it nevertheless is important because this presidential campaign is becoming so much about faith. And Jay Carney was about Rick Santorum's statements about the president and faith and religion,
right,
and phony theology.
And this morning we had Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, on Joe Scarborough's show saying that maybe Obama's a secret Muslim. Who knows?
Yeah, suggesting he couldn't be sure that he was not a Muslim. And Jay Carney addressed that, said that he'd actually met with the president for 45 minutes and that subject had not come up because the president was focusing on jobs and growing the economy. So what he said about the Santorum thing was
Can you imagine being, you know, working for the President of the United States and walking into his office and saying, sir, are you a secret Muslim?
I know. Can you imagine?
It's like, what? What?
I know.
What planet are you on?
I mean, I know you've got a rug on the floor, but
yeah.
Is it a normal rug or
right.
What's that bowl of water doing?
You
know?
Right.
I know. So anyway,
and then there's the subtext of that, which is that there's something wrong with being a Muslim, which is equally offensive, by the way.
There's something wrong with being a Muslim, which apparently has already been decided.
By whom?
By certain elements among the Republican primary electorate.
Oh, I see. And that's why Joe Scarborough was horrified at Franklin Graham suggesting that Obama might be a secret Muslim, because, oh, my God, you wouldn't want anybody to be accused of that. It's like accusing him of being, you know, a secret felon.
Yeah, but I think also, you know, and Carney addressed this because he immediately referred everybody to statements, and I would have done the same thing myself, that the president made at the recent National Prayer Breakfast about his Christian faith. The president was extremely blunt, outspoken, and heartfelt about his Christian faith.
Yes.
And it was really a public confession of his Christian faith.
Right, and which shouldn't even be necessary, but there it is.
But there it is, and there it was. So Carney said, look, the president is focused on doing what he was elected to do, working with Congress or independently to grow the economy and create jobs. He said, you guys can decide what's a story and what is not.
Yeah.
He said that a couple of times.
And they do.
And they certainly do. Meanwhile, over at the Supreme Court of the United States, a couple of interesting things. As you know, there's a big healthcare hearing coming up in about a month's time.
Yes.
Well, it's possible that the Supreme Court might punt on this till 2014. That is what court watchers are starting to say.
Right, because of this law that says that you can't, a court can't rule on a tax until the tax is in place. And if Obamacare, if the mandate is a tax, it doesn't go into effect until 2014.
That's right. The Anti-Injunction Act. You can't hold a tax that hasn't yet been collected. It seems so logical to me, but I'm not a lawyer. Well, it's interesting because the Fourth Circuit last fall tossed out a lawsuit against the mandate on this basis, and most courts have said the statute doesn't apply here. Well, very interestingly, the Supreme Court today increased the time for next month's oral arguments from 5.5 hours to 6 hours, allotting an extra half hour to discuss the application of the Anti-Injunction Act. So it will get an hour and a half to decide whether the court has the authority to rule on the health care law this year.
Well, and not only that, because both the Obama administration and the states bringing this case, or the people bringing this case against the Obama administration, agree that it's that the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply here, the Supreme Court has appointed its own lawyers to argue in front of itself.
That's right. They're bringing in their own hired guns.
Right. So that says to me that John Roberts has got something up his sleeve and that he does not want to be a political pinata this year any more than he already is because of Citizens United.
I think that's a possibility. I think it's quite a possibility. Not a decision today. They agreed to hear a major case on affirmative action in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Texas case, a Supreme Court 5-4 decision in 2003. That public colleges and universities could not use a point system to boost minority enrollment, but they could take race into account in a vaguer way to ensure academic diversity. Now, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who wrote the majority opinion, said the accommodation was meant to last 25 years.
Okay.
And it's not, obviously, because they've decided to hear a particular case.
Right.
And now they have Justice Alito on the case, replacing her, who tends to side with the court's conservative justices in decision, pretty hostile to the use of racial classifications by the government.
Interesting.
In addition, Anthony Kennedy, who's the swing justice, has never voted to uphold an affirmative action program.
Very interesting.
So this will be very interesting when this one's heard. I think it's quite possible that affirmative action, even though there are some narrow aspects to this,
mm-hmm.
It could be that it's going down.
The whole doctrine gets knocked down.
I think it's possible it's going to go down.
Yeah.
We had major protests today at Bagram Air Force Base because U.S. military had burnt Qurans, apparently mistakenly. Apparently they got mixed up with some other bundle of a material bound for incinerator, and they were burned.
And so the local religious folks in Afghanistan are upset with us about this.
They're very upset with us about this. I think, you know, from their point of view, justifiably so. And then I think that there are some others who've decided to pile it on. So I think it's a combination of things.
Well, this is the problem when you occupy somebody else's country.
It's complicated.
Yes.
General John Allen, the top U.S. military officer, has apologized to Hamid Karzai, the president, the people, and offered a full investigation.
Okay. Well, let's hope that that slows it down, because it would be really nice if this thing didn't blow up before we got out of there.
Indeed.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Carrie Lucas from the Managing Director of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, on the line with us. Carrie, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Tom. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Where are you these days?
I'm actually in Brussels.
In Brussels, Belgium?
Yes, I sure am.
Wow, the socialist paradise.
Another one, exactly. Used to be Austrian. Here I am. But.
Free national health care. So what I wanted to talk to you about is this whole Republican war on women, it seems like, is going on. From Foster Freeze saying, and he has walked this back, but, you know, back in my day, birth control was a aspirin between your knees, and this bill in Virginia about, you know, a forced state-run, I guess, ultrasound, intravaginal ultrasound if you're going to have an abortion, and declaring a fertilized egg a person, which would mean that, I guess, that many forms of contraception, at least the hormonal contraception, would become illegal because they prevent implantation. And it could lead to a whole lot of other things. Any woman who has a miscarriage has to report herself to the police department to determine if she played a role in it or not. What's going on?
You know, first of all, I think that at least the first two examples you're talking about is not a war on women, but it's a war Republicans are waging on themselves. You know, some of the optics of what's gone on in the last few weeks has just been terribly done. I mean, the Republicans have turned what should be a really important issue, because I think, Tom, when you're, you know, I'm glad you're bringing up this example of what's going on in Virginia with this mandated procedure, because, you know, I think that we should all take a step back and say, hey, why are we putting government in charge of healthcare decisions? And I don't think that the state of Virginia should be dictating the decisions made by a woman and her doctor. But I also don't think that President Obama or a bureau of 12 guys sitting in federal government in a few months as Obamacare becomes implemented, that they should be deciding procedures either. But that is the direction we're going in, and why I think we all Americans should be a little worried about this concentration of power over healthcare decisions, which is taking place, putting them the government instead of with doctors and patients.
In principle, I don't disagree with you at all. I think, though, that in this dialogue, what is being lost, and I think, frankly, in the national dialogue, what is being lost is the difference between government making decisions for individuals and governments making decisions for corporations. Because I have no problem with government saying, you know, if the Belgian government where you live saying, you know, okay, here's our healthcare here's our national healthcare program. It covers A, B, C, D, Q, and R. And if you want more than that, you can buy a private health insurance plan, which you can do in Belgium, which will give you, which will fill in the holes in the national healthcare program. So here's our basic program. And by the way, if you're an employer, in Belgium, employers don't have to provide health care. And so a national health care plan would really get government out of the business of either telling you or me what we have to do or not do, or what our doctor has to do or not do, and telling employers what they have to provide or not provide.
Except, Tom, I think that we know when government sets policy, when government decides, okay, from now on, only mammograms for women over 50. They haven't said that yet. I mean, that was something that was flirted with and then was walked back.
No, even that wasn't flirted with, Carrie. What they were talking about was doing a risk-benefit analysis of what is the point at which the X-rays from a mammogram are more likely to cause cancer 10, 15 years down the road, because that's the gestation period for cancers. At what point are the mammogram X-rays going to be doing more harm than good? And on younger women, they actually produce more cancers than they find.
No, that wasn't what it was. It was a cost benefit analysis of how much, how many, and we do, if we are going to, as a nation, and this is what happens all over the place in socialized medicine, you do have to start thinking about things in terms of dollars and cents. And
you think that United Healthcare doesn't do that?
Oh, of course. Healthcare, I mean, it's ridiculous for us to have any conversation to pretend that money doesn't play a role in...
Right. Aetna's doing it. Blue Cross is doing it. The government would do it. The government of Belgium does it. Everybody has to.
Sure. But I think, Tom, when we think about the government, it's not just another... I mean, and obviously the insurance companies that you mentioned are huge, and I wish it was much more competitive marketplace. I think it's bad that we have the system that we have today, in which we have this total bias towards employer-provided health care, which makes it so people have so few options. But certainly that's better than if government is the one entity that decides, hey, this gets an A rating, therefore everybody has to require it. That means that it's going to become, that's pretty much going to become, if not the law of the land, it's going to become functionally the law of the land. And I would hope that, you know, liberals out there who are so horrified by the conversations that have been going on about contraception, and I think we've gotten into a really weird place because, you know, there's nobody. This is a total distraction from the larger issues of healthcare and what is the proper role of government, which is essentially what this is. But Democrats out there should be wondering, okay, you know, so right now we're the guys in charge, and so we're going to say everybody gets free free whatever. And we're going to just force companies to pay to provide this free good. Well, what happens if there was, you know, if Rick Santorum is the boogeyman that the left wants to make him out to be and hates contraception? Well, then he's going to say, okay, now it's You set up this machinery of the government making all decisions about what everyone must pay for and what everybody's insurance must entail. Well, you know, what if you guys, if you guys are right and some crazy right winger comes in charge and makes a totally different set of decisions? There's a reason why we don't want to concentrate all this power with government.
But see, that set of decisions, Carrie, would be whether or not an employer has to include birth control as part of the stuff that they pay for if they're going to have a drug benefit. And it seems to me that if you're going to have a drug benefit and you're going to offer things like Viagra and you're going to offer things, well, frankly, anything. I don't think anything should be excluded. I don't think they should say, you know, you can have
so
a health care benefit, but we're not going to cover certain kinds of cancer medication.
Okay, so but Tom, obviously, as we talked about before, there is a cost to all this, right? So you can't just have every drug that everybody wants paid for and nobody have, you know, where is this, you know, is this the tooth fairy coming down and handing this stuff out?
Well, this is why you need the, you know, you said you wish there was more competition in the healthcare industry. This is why it is so hard for a small company to get into the healthcare business, because when somebody is really, really sick, it can be a multi-million-dollar expense. It's very rare, but in a small group of people or a small company that's only insuring a few thousand or tens of thousands of people, a couple of people could bring that company down. And so when you've got anything like that where the stakes are really high and the potential costs are really high, like the cost of fighting World War II, that could only be borne by the federal government. And that's why, you know, part of the commons is our military. And I would submit to you that healthcare costs – when, you know, can be so large that they should be part of the commons too. We should
Tom,
be like,
you know what? I think let's say you and I can agree. Let's say for argument's sake that government is going to be the insurer of last resort in those catastrophic care, the things that we all like you worry about. You know, you don't want to be
sure.
The cancer millions of dollars. But that's in the same way that's why we have car insurance that pays for the big wreck. But you don't have car insurance for gasoline. You don't have car insurance to cover the cost of an oil change. And birth control, you know, it's sure it's an expense, you know, $20 a month or something, but that's the equivalent of an oil change. That is not catastrophic care.
Well, actually, your car insurance company will give you a discount if you can demonstrate that you're less likely to wreck your car by not getting speeding tickets. And that's you know, and with birth control, what they found was that the cost of pregnancy is so much greater than the cost of birth control that companies are actually going to save money by offering birth control.
Well, Tom, then it shouldn't have to be a government mandate. that's a little bit far-fetched, I think.
You know, okay, I can't knock that one down. We'll leave it at that. Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org is the website. Carrie, always great talking with you.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on.
And say hi to the socialist paradise of Belgium for me.
I sure will.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting, interesting times we live in. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mark in Birmingham, Michigan. Listen, WDTW. Hey, Mark, what's up?
You know, just picking up on your previous guest, you know, I lived in Canada and Israel for quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Canada, so I had experience with socialized medical systems.
Actually, neither of those are socialized medical systems. They're both single-payer healthcare systems. The government doesn't own the hospitals in Canada. They're privately owned. And they don't own the hospitals in Israel. They're privately owned.
Excuse me.
The UK is more like socialized medicine.
Okay, thanks. What happens in Canada is that all the resources get used up on what your previous guest called oil changes. People run to the doctor for the common cold, et cetera, things that you and I now wouldn't do. And then when you need cancer treatment or some type of heart surgery, the resources are minimized. Also, what happens is the government figures
actually,
out.
Actually, no. No. That's a myth. The fact of the matter is, in Canada, if you need a hip replacement, you're going to have to wait 6 months to a year. But if you need heart surgery, you're going to get it tomorrow. And you know, this is not in dispute. I realize the right wingers love to go on about it, but it's frank. It's not in dispute. And your call is going to provoke an avalanche, except for the fact that every single line is slammed right now, so nobody can get in. But typically, when people come on like you and say things like what you said, I get all these calls from Canadians.
Well, can I make one other point?
Yes, sir.
The other way that the government controls costs is they figured out how much it costs to, educate a doctor. So what they do is they just, every year they cut the number of doctors they allow to enter medical schools. For example, in Windsor, when my doctor retired, I couldn't find a general practitioner. I had to call a colleague, and he had to call his doctor and say, look, I know you're full. You're not taking new patients. Can you please let my, he's a good friend of mine. He'll be a good patient. Can you let him in? So what happens is there's shortages.
Oh, there's a shortage here in the United States. Mark, when I moved to Washington, D.C., it took me 5 months to find a doctor that would see me within 6 months just for a physical.
Yeah, well,
just for a physical for my health insurance that my health insurance company required. It took me 5 months of calling around. I could not find and ultimately, you know what they have in most of the doctors, or not most, many of the doctors in Washington, D.C., they're going to this thing where they're calling it concierge medicine, and you pay them a $3,000 cash payment every year, and just to be a patient, and then they limit their practice to like 100 or 200 people, and they don't take insurance. I mean, that's what's happening
in
the United States.
In a free market, the government is meddling already left and right. In a free market,
it is. I agree with you. That this is, and in Canada, one of the problems that you have is because doctors make so much more in the United States, you've got a brain drain going on. You've got physicians coming to the United States to practice.
Oh,
and
the
reason doctors make more in the United States is because the AMA and a couple of licensing agencies that are associated with them control not only the number of people who get in and out of medical school, but more importantly, the number of residencies that there are in the hospitals, and which you've got to go through in order to become a full MD. And this is a real problem in the United States, and our problem has gotten contagious, and it's affecting particularly cities like Windsor, which are right next door to the United States. But that is not a problem with how we're paying for medical care. The question is not do you want the government to be paying for your health care or not. The question is, do you want the government to be paying for your health care, which a government that you can petition for redress of grievance, a government that you can replace, you can throw the bums out if you don't like them, a government that you can lobby, in fact, a government that you can become if you decide to run for political office, or do you want a giant transnational health insurance company providing your health insurance, where if you try to petition them, if you try to talk back to them, if you try to pick at the CEO's house, you can get arrested? Which one do you want?
I want a monopoly. So if I don't like my insurance company, I go to someone else. If I don't like the government,
good luck.
And they're the monopoly.
Dream on.
Then there's
dream on. You've got monopolies in the health insurance industry right now.
Well, why is that? That's government intervention.
No, it's a lack of government intervention. It's because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and so these companies got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It used to be that every state. Insurance companies had to operate within a state and only within a state. When I grew up in Michigan, it was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan that I was providing to my employees for free, and it was costing me $38 a month per person in the 70s.
But that's the government.
It was a nonprofit organization. No, it was the government keeping competition in the marketplace.
No, I can't buy insurance in California. Why is that?
Because
the government is stopping me from doing that.
No, it's because the government has not been breaking up these big companies. They are not enforcing competition. They're allowing monopoly. You've got it upside down, Mark. You've got it upside down.
Why can't you buy health insurance across state lines? Who prevents you from doing that?
That's
not the insurance companies.
Do you really want a situation where health insurance is like our credit cards and you find one state like North Dakota that says, okay, we're going to do away with all the regulations and standards and there will be no protection for you whatsoever, and all the insurance companies register themselves in North Dakota like all the credit card companies have done? The whole selling across state lines thing is a way of doing away with local control. Right now, every state in the union has an insurance commissioner who has the power to say, no, you will not screw the citizens of my state, and I will stop you from doing that. And some states are better at it than others. Some states have more aggressive insurance commissioners than others. But the big insurance companies and the conservatives are saying, oh, let's do away with those state insurance commissioners. Let's take away the power of the individual states to look out for their citizens. I think that the idea, I would think the conservative idea would be, let's have we the people have a government that is more responsive to we the people at the local level. And your suggestion that you be able to sell health insurance across state lines, these companies exist across state lines. United Healthcare is operating in all 50 states, but in each state they have to respond to the insurance commissioner of that state. And this sell across state lines mythology is just that. It's a mythology, and all it would do is make your health insurance even worse, just like with credit cards.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But it would make the health insurance companies more profitable, so the CEO of United Healthcare, instead of just making $1 billion, could make $2 billion. Oh, that's definitely the good, the bad, and the very, very parvacentiously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, Ben and Jerry's, the two ice cream kings behind the famed company, Jerry Greenfield and Ben Cohen, launched a campaign against the Citizens United case last week. Their Get the Dough Out of Politics campaign is aimed to draw attention to the Citizens United decision and raise awareness about its devastating effects on our political landscape. The campaign's website, getthedoughout.org, asks people to sign up to campaign against Citizens United. Ben & Jerry's CEO, Jostein Solheim, said, "We feel that the time is now, during an election year, and that this is the new issue to highlight as the new American dream." And he went on to say, "We're speaking on behalf of the 99% using our pulpit as an activist company to highlight the fact that things are topsy-turvy." End of quote. It is this type of grassroots activism by Ben and Jerry's that is needed to help overturn Citizens United and restore the power of the people in the political landscape. The bad. Indiana State Representative Bob Morris. Morris refused to sign a resolution honoring the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts, stating that the radicalized organization supports abortion, homosexuality, and sexually promiscuous agenda. Morris told colleagues in a letter that, "I did a little research, amount of web-based research, and what I found is disturbing." Morris told colleagues that abundant... Anyway, he went off on this. Anyhow, let's go to the next one. And the very, very ugly Franklin Graham. Franklin Graham, the son of the Reverend Billy Graham, told Morning Joe this morning that he didn't know if President Obama was a Christian. When asked by Willie Geist whether or not President Obama was a Christian, Graham replied, "You have to ask him. I cannot answer that question for anybody." Graham also refused to categorically say the president wasn't a Muslim. He told Geis, "I can't say categorically because Islam has gotten a free pass under Obama," referring to the notion that Christian minorities throughout the entire world were coming under attack by Muslims, mainly after the events of the Arab Spring. President Obama has continued to fight the war on terror throughout the Islamic world. He certainly has not given Islam a free pass by any means. This continued irrelevant talk about the president's religion by Graham and others has no place in today's society and is very, very ugly. And that said, Patty in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, what's up, Patty?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I was just calling in because you're having a debate with a young lady from Belgium, and she made a point that just kind of bothered me. She was trying to draw an equivalent between what the government says it will or will not cover versus telling somebody what they actually have to do.
Yes.
So saying that they're going to cover birth control is the same thing as making me do something is drawing an equivalent between those two things. Really,
yes, it's a false
really
equivalency.
Yes, that's the point I want to make.
Yeah, okay. Well, you made it very well. Thank you, and thanks for pointing it out. And that was I was trying to make somewhat that same point, which is that what President Obama has said is, corporations, you have to offer this, not individuals, you have to use this. And, you know, enough of that. Dave in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, you were right. My call was prompted by Mark. Mark seemed to be full of right-wing talking points. But my question to Mark would be that if this system is working so well, why we're ranked 30th in the World Health Organization as far as healthcare.
Yeah.
And a big part of that is because such a large percentage, 50 million people in this country have no healthcare. Another 50 million are underinsured. Yet, on the best case scenario, we pay twice as much as the next closest country for health care, and in some cases, three times as much. We pay 18 to 20% of our GDP. Yes, we have pockets of excellence. Some of the best procedures and surgeries are, you know, most advanced technology is done in this country, but that's basically for millionaires.
Well, it's not exclusive to this country, because if you go into a hospital and you look at those robotic machines that they use, for example, for doing robotic surgery, which is like the big new thing, those machines are made in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. It's like Siemens is making these machines, you know, and
right.
And I mean, they're it's amazing. You walk around the hospital, you look at where the healthcare equipment is made. It's made in Japan and Germany, the real top of the line stuff, and they've got that state-of-the-art stuff in those countries as well. And your
right.
point is absolutely accurate. And not only that, but in the United States, the leading cause of bankruptcy, more than half of all bankruptcies in the United States are because somebody got sick. And more than half of the people who got sick thought they were fully insured when they got sick. And it still wiped
right.
them out.
Exactly. Mark's point about selling across state lines was a talking point. There's no evidence that that would lower the cost of health care. In fact, it probably would raise it.
Just like with credit cards.
That's correct. And I was waiting for Mark to mention tort reform, the other myth.
Yeah.
You know,
Texas tried that. You know, they capped it at $250,000. If a Texas doctor does something to you or your child that ends up in lifelong disability and disfigurement, and it's going to cost you millions of dollars to care for them, the most you can sue that doctor for is $250,000. And the most that that doctor's health insurance company malpractice insurance company has to pay is $250,000. And it has not decreased the cost of health care in Texas appreciably at all. The impact was a fraction of 1%. So, yeah.
Exactly. Lawsuits have proven to be 1% the cost of the rise in health care since the late 90s, and that is several studies. It's well known, and it's just a myth.
Yeah.
Just, you know, they want to leave it so to where we don't have any place to go for justice.
Right. The main thing about tort reform is they basically want to make all corporations in all cases invincible, unanswerable to us. They're unanswerable to us right now through the political process. You can't petition a corporation the way that you can a government. They want to make it so that you can't sue a corporation either. And it's just nuts. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Ron in Minot, North Dakota. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, thanks. Well, here in North Dakota, the public employees and most of the insurance companies are Blue Shield Blue Cross. The ugliness of Blue Shield Blue Cross came apparent in 2009 when for 34 employees of Blue Shield Blue Cross they came an island bonus. They brought on their profit margin is above 80% using their profits. This was write-offs. You know, the profits they pay dividends out of. So, you know, it's making profit out of our ill health. But they threw a party in the Cayman Islands that cost them $238,000, and they put.
You're kidding.
34.
This
is all ugliness. And they put, you can Google this, just Google this, Blue Shield Blue Cross North Dakota, you'll find it. They hosted 34 employees there. Well, the guy who did that in Blue Shield Blue Cross was fired. But the truth is, they still continue to spend over $1.2 million every year to reward their salaried employee, their CEO's, trips and hotel stays as part of their bonuses. They pay bonuses, $15 million in bonuses. And they
That's
invest
incredible.
In hotel businesses. They use their dividends. I mean, they use their profit. You know, what they pay in dividend is different from what they actually count as expenditures. They use that as investments. Now, if we were a single payer tax system, all of us it would be like Social Security. All of us would pay into one big pot like Social Security.
Yep.
And then our health needs would be met by that big pool.
And Social Security Social Security has never missed a check. They've never missed a payment, and I guarantee you that the green eye shades guys who work at the men and women who work at the Social Security Administration, or for that matter Medicare, you know, they're basic government salaried employees. They're making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, depending
on some accountability checks on them.
And they're not getting bonuses, and they're not getting trips to St. Kitts and
Cayman Islands. No, what we're doing is we're urinating in a small pool here, and what they do is they pay because they have a profit margin. The insurance companies set a profit margin. You know, a government, a single payer tax thing wouldn't set a profit margin. It would be non-profit making. Yeah. These guys set a profit margin, and then to keep their people, they keep offering these bonuses and high CEO salaries out of our money.
I know.
It doesn't go to our health.
I know, and it's money that they made from saying no, you can't have that operation, no, you can't have that procedure. We've got to give the bonus to the CEO. Ron, thanks for the call. Excellent, well said. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hey, an observation, and I have a question about David Hume.
Sure.
The observation is people are becoming more and more aware of the big donors because I hear it on the news when I'm driving in my car, and the local news comes on.
Yeah,
they actually name the big donor, which they never did before.
Yeah, no, it's
but people
it's,
are becoming more aware.
Yeah, it's shuttling. You know, people have figured out. You know that Newt Gingrich is a frontman for Shelley Adelson, and Rick Santorum is a frontman for Foster Freeze, and Mitt Romney's a frontman for John Paulson, and you know it's pretty straightforward. And before Obama said okay for his super PAC, they'd only raised $58,000, so they didn't have any billionaires yet. But it's just this is not how politics should be. It's just, you know, very, very simply not how politics should be. And I'm astounded that more Americans aren't outraged that these guys, basically these billionaires coming forward to fund these campaigns, the Koch brothers with Scott Walker up in Wisconsin, things like that, that you know, we have wholly owned politicians. They're wholly owned subsidiaries of giant corporations or interests that are you know, owned and run by other people. And that there's not more horror about this. Actually, I think there is. Thank you for the call. There's a lot of blowback, and you're seeing it in things like movetoamend.org. And all these movements to amend the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because the Supreme Court, this activist right-wing Supreme Court, has handed our democracy over to corporations and billionaires, and it's not good.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay,
there's a great article over at the Daily Beast by Willard Stern Randall. Washington was broke. Why founding fathers were strapped for cash. And they talk about how George Washington took the job of president. He wrote a letter to Henry Knox, one of his old friends. He said, "My movements to the chair of government will be accompanied with feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of his execution." Why did he take the job of president? Because, as Willard Stern Randall writes, he was broke. He needed the job. To his favorite nephew, George Augustine Washington, he said, "Necessity would have forced me into frugality as my means were not adequate to the expenses which I have lived since my retirement to what is called a private life." In other words, he needed a job. In fact, he lost half his net worth in the Revolutionary War. More than half of the people who signed that document lost everything that they had in the Revolutionary War. And George Washington, British raid on Mount Vernon, stripped him of his livestock. He tried to sell land. He couldn't. So there was this post-Revolutionary War depression, basically. He bartered for everything, for virtually everything he needed. I'm quoting from the article here. He swapped fish caught in the Potomac for shingles, planks, nails, and rum for the field hands at the harvest time. He abandoned tobacco planting and instead raised wheat because he could sell it to his neighbors. With that cash from the wheat, he paid for stud feeds for mules, which he'd introduced into America because they ate less than horses. And then with that money, he used that money to pay his taxes. I mean, George Washington was broke. And he goes on to this, you know, he actually had to borrow the cash to get to the Constitutional Convention from his next-door neighbor, George Mason. And he goes on to say, Washington's cash-poor lifestyle was typical of other founding figures. Jefferson accepted payments of debts owed to him during the Revolution in worthless continental currency, but after losing the war, British merchants refused to accept American currency. He never recovered financially. When he died, he was broke. His heirs lost Monticello. Alexander Hamilton could only afford a brief stay as a New York delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He made one six-hour speech, then went back to his 57 Maiden Lane law office to earn the money to support his seven children. When Hamilton died in a duel, Philip Schuller, who was his father-in-law, his family in 1804, his father-in-law couldn't afford to bury him. Mourners packing St. Paul's Chapel passed the hat for his Alexander Hamilton for his burial expenses in the graveyard across the street from the Wall Street that he had created. Oh, yeah, those guys, they were so rich. No, they weren't. It's, you know, as I pointed out many times, and this is all in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? The richest of the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence was John Hancock. He was worth about $700,000 in today's money. He would be called the upper middle class today. In fact, if he was living in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Manhattan, he would be called middle class or broke. That's more than a decent house costs. I mean, it's in some of those areas. So it was not of, by, and for the rich. It was, ultimately that's what we've become, where you've got people like Mitt Romney running for office, you know, paying 15% income tax on the $40 million he earned over the last 2 years. It's nuts. Rich in San Francisco. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Actually, first time caller, long time listener.
Thank you.
Just wanted to make a comment about that guy with the California healthcare. Just to let you know how badly they don't believe in capitalism. I get my health insurance through my wife's business, you know, where she works. Mm-hmm. And just this year, they actually made it mandatory for us to use one specific pharmacy.
Oh, interesting. Because right? they'd cut a deal with that pharmacy. Yeah.
Exactly, right? So, but the real reason why I called was I have a buddy who thinks he's a Republican, and, you know, we have some pretty good debates. And yesterday, we brought up the refining capacity issue that you've been talking about lately, and I didn't have enough information, you know, so I went looking for it. The two reasons why I found that the refineries are shutting down were because of either Chinese or Indian gasoline being imported cheaper. Same thing with the UK, because the UK the Euro Union, because they've been changing over to diesel, so there's a lot of their gasoline available to us.
The world is awash in gasoline right now. It's our major export. So, we're exporting more expensive gasoline that we refine, and we're importing cheap gasoline.
Yeah, so I guess my question was, because his point was that regulations, or high regulations, were causing the refiners to go out of business.
Yeah, which is nonsense.
And
just ask him for one story of one refiner that went out of business because of one regulation. Please name that regulation and name that refiner. And if you can do that, you know, I'll give you $50 or whatever. I don't make money bets on the air, but you can't do it. You can't do it, because I guarantee you, I absolutely guarantee you, Rich, if there was one refinery that had gone out of business in the last 30 years in the United States because of one regulation, that would be the poster child that all the Republicans would be talking about. Hey, did you hear about the BP refinery in Butte, Montana, that went out of business because they couldn't afford the scrubber on the roof, or on their smokestack? Look at that. They went broke. There is no such thing. It's like Reagan's welfare queen, where, you know, Reagan, when he was running in the primary that he lost in 76, when he was running against... Who was it? Jerry Ford, I guess it was. And Bob Dole. Ronald Reagan said, you know, there's this woman in New York who's making $150,000 a year. She's got 15 different Social Security numbers and 12 different, and all this. And he completely made it up out of thin air. And the New York Times said, well, where is she? Let's go look at her. Let's check this out. And in fact, the New York Bureau of whatever it is, welfare or something, said, who is she? We want to nail her. You know, we're going to bust her. And Reagan was like, well, no, actually, there isn't such a person. I'm sorry. I don't know. So that's the thing. Ask them for some proof. You will not get it.
Well,
Rich,
I was going to say, I think his opinion was that they were going offline because they were getting old and they were no longer profitable, and that there's this inability to to build new because of federal regulations. And that's why, like I said.
Well, that's even ask them to prove it. They can't. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. We got to wrap up the show. We'll be back tomorrow with more. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you get out there, when you get active, tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.